buddy Adam Chartoff here,
host of FOMOX Radio. You're listening to episode number 426 of the podcast. It's the weekend. It's, let's see, today I'm recording this on Saturday, September the 9th. And, you know, the world has gone Koyaanisqatsi on us, hasn't it? It's a little frightening. No, it's not a little bit. It's very frightening. And for those who are, if for some reason I'm reaching somebody who is in Texas, in Mexico, in Florida, in the Caribbean, where any level of devastation has occurred, or if you're listening, your family or your friends have experienced any level of devastation due to any of these disasters, any of these climate-related disasters, my thoughts are with you, absolutely, and this goes out to you. I honestly, okay, let's get into the a podcast episode right now, because anything else I say, I believe, will sound a little bit too superficial. But the show itself, compared to what's going on, is a bit superficial. So I have to kind of be okay with that. What else is there to do but forge on with our lives in whatever capacity that looks like? So anyway, this episode came together rather quickly. Crispin Glover is the guest. What happened was I was sent a link. I was sitting in the Alamo Draft House and I ran into somebody I kind of knew. We started talking. He said, "Are you aware that Crispin Glover is coming to Alamo Draft House later in the month and doing this presentation he does?" And I'm like, "No. Why don't I know that?" He said, yeah. "And I think he'd be a great guest, and I wouldn't be surprised if he did your show." I said, "Okay." So this acquaintance, friend, sent me, forwarded me the email, and from Crispin Glover's newsletter, from his website and all that, and I replied to it. And the next thing I know, I get an email back from Crispin Glover, who is, I think he's based in, although he travels all the time, he's actually based in the Czech Republic. So he says, "Yes, let's do it." So we did it over Skype. It sounds great. I just want to say that when sometimes I've done in the past a phone recording or a Skype recording, and it doesn't always sound great, but I've kind of gotten it down to a science, and it sounds great. So just go know that within seconds it'll be as though he's in the room. I mean, it'll feel that kind of intimacy in the conversation. It's interesting because one of the reasons I prefer, I mean, there are two reasons why I like to do, avoid, you know, anything but in-person conversations. One is a sonic reason, or, you know, because it just sounds so much better. The other thing, though, is that you create an intimacy, a connection, you know. This wasn't necessary. I started, you know, with Crispin. He's a talks, like he's the perfect guest. I always call people, when you ask them a question, they can talk for 10 minutes. That it's actually the perfect guest, because I'm not, people don't want to hear me. They want to hear the other person. So that's the case here. So that is what's going to go on now. Here, let me just tell you what's happening here so I can do Crispin the justice of letting you guys know what's going on. If you are in the New York metropolitan area, which includes technically, I suppose, Connecticut, New Jersey, Long Island, or Westchester, I think that's kind of the area. So these are four events, two of which take place at the Alamo Draft House on the September 19th and 20th. And then a couple of days later, in Woodbridge Township, New Jersey, on the 23rd and 24th. Okay, so if you're anywhere close to those two events, and if tickets are available right now, look into it. What's happening is Crispin Glover, he's created this traveling event that he does, which is a combination of various types of performance. He's directed a couple of films, even though he's working on a third one. He's doing, at the Alamo Draft House in Brooklyn, on the 19th, he's showing the film It Is Fine, Everything Is Fine. And then on September the 20th, he's showing the film What Is It? And I guess he calls these the It films. And he shows a slideshow, and he does a spoken word thing over that. And then he does a Q&A, and then he does a book signing. So not only do you get to be brought up to date on the creative works of Crispin Hellion Glover, but you get to also engage with him and ultimately to meet him. So he's very available. He wants to present his art to audiences, and he wants to meet them. So what I just described is going to go on there also at the New Jersey Horror Convention and Film Festival in Woodbridge Township, New Jersey. Go to CrispinGlover.com for more details about all that and for tickets and everything else. I plan on being at the Alamo Drafthouse on the 20th for the second night. I will be there. That is the plan anyway. You know, all the best laid plans, but that is the plan. So if you're there, look out for me, because I would love to run into friends and listeners. So Crispin was a great guest. Many people know him, of course, for his popular works, including, you know, of course, the original first installment of Back to the Future, as well as the two Charlie's Angels movies. But of course, he's done tons of work, and we talk about it in this conversation. But most of it is actually his feelings about art and commerce. We talk a lot about corporate financed art, mostly film, but art in general. He's on a tear. He really feels passionate about this subject. And so we spend the majority of time talking about people versus corporations. And I know it's going to seem a little bit offbeat, but not if you're familiar with Crispin Hellion Glover and the type of guy he is. So this was a great guest, because Crispin has always been somebody who's been on the list that I keep, this long list of my people who I would always love to have. And I didn't expect that within a couple of days that this would all work out. So it is something I felt compelled to put up online as quickly as I could. I edited it real quick, and so here it is. So we're going to play this for you right now, my conversation with Crispin, and then there will not be an outro at the end. So just listen to the show, enjoy it, and we'll be back in really literally in a couple of days with a brand new episode of the podcast. We're going on a bit of a tear ourselves here. Okay, so thank you for listening, everybody. Here it is, Crispin Glover, only on Filmwax Radio, podcasting with me right now. Enjoy. Hi, Crispin.
How are you doing?
I'm good.
Good.
It is you.
Yes. This is me.
Well, I'm glad this worked out.
Yeah, me too.
Basically, my friend, we were talking, and he knows that I do this podcast, and he said, you know, do you know that Crispin Glover's coming into town? We were sitting in the Alamo Draft House when this happened.
Oh, good.
And so it's perfect. So he then, and I said, no, great. And he forwarded me the information, and I emailed you right away.
Yeah. Have we started?
Yeah. Oh, I apologize. I am so conversational that people don't know when I begin and end. Yes, we're now officially going. Crispin Glover, you're going to be at the Alamo Draft House here in Brooklyn on September the, correct me if I'm wrong, 20th and 21st?
I believe that's correct, yes.
We'll confirm that, but okay. And let's talk about what you're doing, because this is like a real Crispin Glover festival.
We should also mention that I'm at the Alamo Draft House, and then I'm at the New Jersey Horror Convention and Film Festival in Woodbridge Township, New Jersey, on September 23rd and 24th.
Very good.
And so people can find out more information on CrispinGlover.com.
Okay, and we'll also put it in the show notes, the description of the show. We'll also add that so people can have it right there. I'll put all the details.
Right.
Exactly, how to get tickets and everything else.
Exactly. On CrispinGlover.com, there are links to the pages for where people can buy tickets.
Now, before you tell everything that you're going to be, all the different components of this show, because it's really, it's sort of a multi-discipline type of thing. You've got films, you're doing spoken word, you're doing, and more. So when did the idea come about, and how long have you been doing this at various times?
Well, it was interesting when you just said this is the real Crispin Glover Festival. It's true, because I'd never put it that way, but this is many years of work compacted into two subsequent nights. This is work that goes back to as long ago as 1984.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, because I have 8 books in each show. They're 2 different live, what I call Crispin, Hogan, Glover's Big Slideshow, parts 1 and 2.
Oh, right.
And I started making the books in 1983. I think the oldest book that's in the show is in 1984. These are visually, these are old books taken from the 1800s that have been reworked and turned into different books from what they originally were. And they're virtually every page is illustrated. And I have 8 different of these books that have been converted into slides.
Mm-hmm.
And I dramatically narrate the books. Each show is about an hour long for the slideshow part. So I do one slideshow before one of the feature films and then another slideshow before another feature film. So the feature films, part one, what is it? I started shooting in 1996. I premiered it in Sundance in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
That film is called What Is It?
Mm-hmm.
And the second film, It Is Fine, Everything Is Fine, I shot in 2000 and 2001, and we premiered that in Sundance in 2007. Then after each of the films, again, these are done on subsequent nights. So one show is devoted to one film, and another show is devoted to another film. Then after each of the films, I have a 1.5-hour Q&A, and then after the Q&A, I have a book signing where, you know, everyone that has something to sign is I meet with till everybody's done. So it's a 4-hour-plus show. It's a very long show. Of course, people don't have to stay for the entire show. They can come in at any time, although generally I advise people come in and see the live show and the film. And then if they want to stay for the Q&A and the book signing, that's fine as well. But then What Is It, the first film, although I actually show them backwards, it doesn't matter which order people see them in for various reasons. I showed that what's part 2 of the trilogy, what will be a trilogy first. Actually, I also will be showing a preview for a new feature film that I've been working on for the last few years. That's not part of the trilogy. It's something a feature film I've been making with myself and my father.
Okay, so it's a little bit of a sneak peek.
My father and I had never acted together before, and
right.
So this is the first time he and I've ever acted together anywhere ever, actually. And so it's really many decades of work that's compiled into a single evening. What is it? Most of the actors in the film have Down syndrome, but the film is not about Down syndrome at all. What really is my psychological reaction to the corporate constraints that have happened in the last 35 years or more of filmmaking, where in anything corporately funded, distributed filmmaking, where in anything that can be possibly make an audience member uncomfortable will necessarily be excised,
right?
Or that film will not be corporately funded or distributed, which I think is a very damaging thing because... it's that moment when an audience member sits back in their chair, looks up at the screen and thinks to themselves, is this right what I'm watching? Is this wrong what I'm watching? Should I be here? Should the filmmaker have done this?
Right.
What is?
Right.
And that's the title of the film. What is it that's taboo in the culture? What does it mean when the taboo is ubiquitously excised? Again, I think it's very damaging because when people are asking questions, they're having a genuinely educational experience. And to ubiquitously excise the possibility of real questioning leads to the opposite of education. And what is the opposite of education? It's propaganda. And that's what has been happening in our corporately funded and distributed film community in the last 30 or more years of filmmaking. The second film, It Is Fine, Everything Is Fine, part of the reason that I show it before the first film is it was written by a man named Stephen C. Stewart way back in the late 70s or early 80s. I had actually read his screenplay before I made What Is It? I didn't intend initially for it to be a sequel. What Is It? Was a short film that was going to promote what will ultimately be part three of the trilogy. I ended up turning it into a feature film, at which point I wrote Stephen C. Stewart into the screenplay because I had read his screenplay about a decade before starting to shoot What Is It? Steve was born with a severe case of cerebral palsy, and he was locked into a nursing home when he was in his early 20s. And because it was very difficult to understand his speech, and the people, he did not want to be in this nursing home, and the people that were taking care of him there would derisively call him an MR, a mental retard, which is not a nice thing to call anybody. But Steve was of normal intelligence, and the emotional turmoil he must have gone through for the decade he was in that nursing home.
Unbelievable.
I can't even begin to imagine.
No.
But when he got out, he wrote this screenplay in the style of a 1970s TV murder mystery movie of the week, wherein he's the bad guy. And because he wrote it in this genre style, as opposed to a standard autobiography, there's something very beautiful that comes through in the movie. And really, when the whole trilogy is done, the best film and the trilogy will be this film, the Stephen C. Stewart film. But not only that, it'll be probably the best film I'll have anything to do with in my whole career.
That was the upcoming project?
No. That's the film that was shot in 2000, 2001, premiered in Sundance in 2007.
Oh, excuse me. Okay.
I've been touring with Everything Is Fine for 10 years. Mm-hmm. The new upcoming project is the one that I shot with my father.
Got it.
I'm still editing this film. I actually shot some new stuff just in this last month. I take a long time with these films, and I'm editing that one right now.
Okay, I get it. I'm all caught up then.
That's okay. But I'll be showing a preview for that film as well.
Is your dad here with you?
I'm talking to you from the Czech Republic right now.
My father
lives in Los Angeles.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. I should have been more clear. Will he be with you at these events?
No.
Okay.
My father's not at the events.
Oh, okay.
This is I tour around all over the world. So
sure.
My parents had come seen a number of the shows when I was in Los Angeles, and my father would say hello to
sure.
the audience and talk to people after the show sometimes. So, but he doesn't travel with the shows now.
Also, I like the juxtaposition, how, let's say, the majority of people out there know you from these two corporate franchises that you acted in the past, one in the 80s, of course, one in the 90s. Well, they both were spread out, I suppose, since they were in multiple films. And yet, I really dig how the true Crispin Glover is this really committed artist. And I think when you're talking about, you know, what people are getting stripped of the true art from the films, you know, and what really challenges audiences. And this seems to be really where your inspiration lies.
Well, yeah, it's a funny thing. I'm writing a book right now. I'm on page 460 of this book, and I'm writing about certain things that have to do with this perhaps dichotomy of working both in corporate film and then working on my own films, which have a somewhat anti-corporate bent to them. As I was, I started acting when I was 13. It was something I wanted to do. I wasn't pushed into it, but my parents were supportive. I started professional acting class when I was 15. My father teaches acting, but I never studied with him professionally. I studied at other places, but I'm sure I picked things up from my father along the way.
Sure.
Nonetheless, at age 16, it was 1980 in Los Angeles when I learned how to drive, and I started going to the revival houses in Los Angeles that played all of, you know, older movies, which, of course, in 1980 were films from the 1970s and 60s. And I was studying performances and just films in general as I was going to acting class. And this was really where I kind of fell in love with the art of cinema, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And the films that I was seeing at this time were kind of very questioning films.
Yes.
Films right now, and these are corporately funded films that were studio films, films like, you know, Stanley Kubrick's Clockwork Orange or 2001 or Midnight Cowboy. These are films that were asking questions, or Five Easy Pieces, or Apocalypse Now. Films that were asking questions, and helping people to ask questions. And these are big films that were funded by studios. This was the industry that I was excited as a young actor to step into. And as I started acting in films, I was wondering where these questions were. You had mentioned that I've been a part of a couple of franchises. The one in the 80s, just to be clear, I was only in the first film of Back to the Future. And then some of this has to do with some of the questions that I asked that led to me not being in the sequels to the film.
Oh, I see. Very good.
Then there's... I suppose you mean the other franchise of Charlie's Angels, which was in both of those Charlie's Angels films in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
There have been a couple of other franchises in the 80s. I was in one of the Friday the 13th films.
Okay.
I was in Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland, which they made a sequel to, and then I was in Hot Tub Time Machine, which they made a sequel to as well. So it's true, I've been in a number of franchise-type movies. And like I say, I go into a lot of... I'm going to go into a lot of detail about it in the book that I'm writing, because I do get a lot of questions about these things.
Well, I can't wait to read that. I mean, that sounds like something I really enjoy. You know, I noticed you and I are roughly the same age, so I think we were both definitely we're both inspired by, I think, similar films, since we're kind of coming from the same. I grew up in New York. You grew up in L.A., it sounds like, right?
I was born in New York, but I only lived there till a very young age, and then moved to Los Angeles. And I went to a private school from first to ninth grade, and then 3 years of public high school at the same time that I was also in a professional acting class.
Okay, I see.
In multiple professional acting classes.
Right. Pardon me if I'm misinterpreting anything, but it sounds like because of the substantial Q&A that you've got in both of these events at both Alamo Drafthouse, and then you'll be at the Woodbridge Township at this art center, I suppose, right? I'll make sure all the details are there, but that's on the 23rd and 24th, you said, or the 24th and 25th?
Correct.
23rd and 24th?
I believe so. That's right. Yes.
I'll make sure I'm accurate when I post those.
Right.
But it sounds like because those Q&As are so substantial that, A, you want to engage with your audience, that's something that's very gratifying to you. And then, B, I was wondering if you had ever taught classes yourself, if that gene had taken.
No. I probably would never teach acting classes. That is something that my father does, but I direct the films, and I work with the actors in the film that I direct.
Yeah.
So I work closely with the actors, and I probably get, I have something with that. Of course, it depends on what the skill level of the actor is, or what the necessity for the character is, as to how much consulting I do with the person that's playing the role.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I've worked with people that had Down syndrome in my first film. And interestingly, some of those actors were very experienced and were very capable actors, and some of them were people that had not had very much experience at all. And then I've similarly worked with the range of actors in subsequent films of people that had both a lot of experience as actors and very little. And so I'll work with the different levels or needs of whomever I'm working with. And I do enjoy that process when it's coming to a creation for a specific film. But I'm not motivated to teach specific acting classes. But I do enjoy the Q&As because the films, both What Is It and It Is Fine, Everything Is Fine, and even my stance when I talk about propaganda, it's something which I'm gratified right now in the fact that there is an understanding that's starting to come about. I think some of it has to do with the internet. I was very happy with that Bernie Sanders last year in a very large platform started to let people understand that there were things going on in the government in particular that were not necessarily for the betterment of people at large. But I think, which of course is an important issue, and people are becoming more aware and educated about that in the U.S., my films and what I talk about specifically has to do with the propaganda in the entertainment industry.
Right.
Bernie Sanders is talking more about aspects.
Right, in this political sphere.
It's extremely important, but it's very related to what I've been talking about for many years. So I'm feeling a gratification in that there's a bridge to understanding. When I started touring with What Is It in 2005, in the United States in particular, and I started mentioning the word propaganda, I could tell in the audience, in the United States specifically, people would get annoyed and irritated with this concept that the United States could possibly have propaganda. Now I'm really seeing an acceptance of that. But it's funny, as soon as I would step over the border, going to Canada or certainly going to Europe, people in other countries are very aware that the United States has a large propaganda, functioning propaganda, that people within the United States, particularly, 12, 15 years ago, were not as aware of, because the advent of media on the internet has really helped that there's this discussion and people are seeing behind the facade of that which is being presented. And this is a very important thing, because once people start understanding that propaganda exists, it ceases to function.
That's right.
And that's extremely important for the betterment of...
You can't unring that bell.
Exactly. Once the cat's out of the bag...
Yeah, there's no getting the cat back in.
It's my sense that it's out of the bag. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on that's very concerning, of course, with the president right now and the certain kinds of decimations of seemingly good things for people that...
Right.
At large, they're of concern, but my sense is that there's an understanding amongst a lot of people right now that there's things that are seriously wrong, and it's important that the populace wrestles the control back into people as opposed to corporate interests. And I think that's obvious and becoming more and more obvious all the time, is that the corporate interests are out of bounds. It's out of whack, and it is not serving people's interests. It's serving corporate interests, and this is something that needs to be put back into place. And as people become more aware of it, there are way more people than there are corporations, and corporations only exist because people allow them to do so. So we live in a so-called democracy, even though that's questionable right now.
It is.
The fact that it's called a democracy means that people can take control of it. So that's a good thing.
And maybe the closest version of the democracy we do have, to refer to something you just said earlier, is the internet.
So even that's questionable, because right now, of course, it's another thing that they're trying to take control of with
net neutrality.
With making it so that corporations can pay more money to have faster internet.
For a bigger pipeline.
Net neutrality, which is a very important issue.
And then forget it. I was just going to say, and then forget about you and I having a good connection online, because...
Exactly.
Hey, but
and your podcast would no longer be heard because you wouldn't be able to afford the faster connection.
Hey, wait a minute.
This kind of seeming democratization of getting words out is very important.
Yeah, let's not take it for granted. Yeah, I don't know how much time you have, and I don't want to. You know, I want to be respectful of your time. But I did. I was curious because I really liked how you presented your way into these films and making them and then engaging with people, which is, you know, you grew up watching, or you came into your formative years anyway, watching these, you know, very anti-studio, anti-establishment films, like we said, Bonnie McClyde and 2000, whichever they were definitely coming from a different generation of filmmakers.
The 1960s and 70s, yeah. Something different was going on.
But when you... But when you started, yeah, I agree, and I totally look at it exactly the same way. And when you were ready as a young actor, and you were finding roles, all of a sudden you realize, wait a minute, what happened to these films? You know,
hey,
and so
yeah, that's absolutely correct.
So then you're
it was confusing. I mean, it took me a while to recognize that there was actually a socio-political shift.
Yes.
There was a monetary shift. And this is a large part of what I'm going into in the book, but that's never regained. There's been a control that's wrestled away in the corporate interest, the corporate film, corporately funded and distributed films, that's never gone back to where it was in those decades in particular. There are things that happen every once in a while. There are filmmakers every once in a while that do get something interesting and thoughtful across it, but it's very unusual.
They're outliers, yeah. But I'm curious, because your solution was to to make your own films. At least that was one solution anyhow, for yourself and your own level of gratification. And you already had some good fortune to have been maybe in these corporate films, so you had some built-in audience possibly. Like, how do you get audiences to – how do you find your audiences now that you
– Well, I mean, it's a weird double thought process, because I have worked in films. I won't even say necessarily exactly which ones are. I may go into it a bit more in the book, but it's a funny edge to walk upon, because I work in the corporate industry, and I'm sure there are people that don't like me saying these kind of things that I say that work in the corporate industry. And then there are other people that work in the corporate industry that agree exactly. Most people working in the corporate industry, they started out as young, you know, writers or young directors or young actors or young producers, what have you, cinematographers that wanted to become part of some interesting, thoughtful, artistic community, and then they slowly get drifted into this corporate system that systematizes what people are, how the art is supposed to be put forward. And so I'm sure there are people that have heard me talking about it that say, yeah, that this is right. But, you know, then there are people that work in the industry as well and kind of think I'm a jerk for saying such a thing. So it's a double – I think it's – what I'm saying is very positive, and it's important because, like I say, once the propaganda, people become aware that there's propaganda, it ceases to function. And if it ceases to function, there's no more point for corporate interests to put money behind it. And that means that either a new form of propaganda, or even better, a truthful, artful form starts coming back into play, which would be the best thing of all.
Well, I'm doing my bit here for you and other people.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, in my own little way.
I listen to podcasts and listen to people talking. I think there's something very positive happening with this kind of thing. It's also why I like doing these podcasts.
Lucky for
as
me.
As opposed to something like, I'm still willing to do corporate late night TV or morning television or whatever it is. And like I say, corporate film. But I enjoy when something is, when you can actually talk. And
in complete thought,
you can feel the difference in kind of corporate work, usually, where it's particularly kind of late night talk shows, which have pre-interviews, and they're very short, kind of essentially 5 to 7 minute interviews that have been prefigured out essentially as to what's going to be talked about. So people have their particular stories that they're going to tell. They've told them before, and they come out and they say it. The host kind of knows what the laughs are might be. They say their jokes.
It's
and
just
then
it's
on
practically
to
scripted.
The next.
In other words,
and
it's,
that kind
it's,
of
yeah.
homogenization
right.
of conversation.
Yeah.
It's interesting when people fumble. And they don't quite know exactly what they're going to say, and it might be awkward or imperfect, but sometimes then the actually more interesting thing comes out, and that's important. Like looking at the old Dick Cavett talk shows.
Me too.
The 70s, you can tell those are not pre-scripted.
Oh, totally.
And
there's
no
way.
On for an hour.
Yeah, yeah.
They're actually having good conversations.
Oh, they are. They're long, and they're longer, and they're more quirky, and they would put together a very different variety of guests often. But one of the highlights of my doing this for the last bunch of years is Dick Cavett did the show, too. He did my podcast.
Great.
Can you imagine?
Yeah.
So what were your experiences? I know that you're like one of those seminal, famous guests on Letterman, for instance, when they're putting together when they used to anyway, put together the great moments or the greatest moments, invariably there would be one with you because of your visits. So, but that was all worked out to some degree too. They were expecting the unexpected, in a way you were kind of, it was expected, but how was it scripted at all?
Well, the way that I talk about it in media is that I neither confirm nor deny that I was on the David Letterman show, mm-hmm. but, of course, there's humor in that, but it is something that I'm writing about in the book because I've seen so much conjecture about it, and nobody really understands what any of these things are. So I need to put it out very specifically, and I don't talk about it. And I haven't forever because I've always known that these are things that are easily taken out of context, and there are complexities to mm-hmm. them. So it takes a long time to explain the complexities and what the meanings behind certain actions are or reasons for doing things. And that's a big part of why I'm putting this book together. And again, I'm on page 460 and I haven't finished writing. I'll have to cut it back when I go into editing of it, but there's a lot.
How far along do you think you are in the process of the book? Do you have a sense of, are you like halfway or what do you think?
I feel like I'm more than halfway, but we'll see. I don't like to put limitations on time or anything for my personal projects.
I understand.
My films, for example, generally take many years. I started the new production that I'm working on right now. I started working on in 2008. I started developing it in 2008. I started shooting it 3 or even 4 years ago now. And I just was shooting something last month. I take a long time with my films.
Well, first of all, I really appreciate how seamlessly you keep plugging the book but I understand the context because you really want to connect and be effective in how you get your beliefs and your values to your...
There are things about me
What's that?
There's a public persona that people have seen that really has very little to do with me or my thought process.
Right.
And I've not done too much to let it be known. Of course, I talk about things like propaganda, but even that on some level is not necessarily the connective tissue, so to speak, that brings things together or what the overarching ideas. There are thought processes behind, you know, many of these things that people have a difficult time connecting together as to what I am. I see how people write about me or put things up on the internet, and it's a very confused perception of what it is that I'm genuinely interested in doing or have been putting forth. And I think it's important for it to be put into a framework which is actually on some level concise. And I don't mean that when I was age 23 or what have you that I had everything planned out. But even in my young 20s, I had a certain idea of and reaction to how things were and still are, and in a certain way are more pertinent now than they ever have been. And a lot of it does have to do with this corporatization that seems to be getting stronger, and I was reacting to it from a long time ago, and it's unfortunately I don't see anything actively happening in media that's countering it. I see it happening in people. I think people are aware of it.
Yeah, and they're doing
it. But that means it will at some point, as long as people take a proper stand about it, both intellectually and artistically, it will change. But I don't know that I'm seeing that stand happening, particularly artistically. Sometimes, but I actually feel like that's what is trounced most of anything. Unfortunately, and I understand why, it's like these kind of sociopolitical aspects that people become more alarmed about. And it's understandable. It's people that are, you know, being given poor education or poor medical situations or whatever these things are. But I feel like art itself has been so trodden upon in these last decades. And that when art is a communication that is so important to how people think. And when I say art, I mean so many of the arts, whether it's music or writing or film or acting or there's been a denunciation and a lambasting of abstract art, which is negative. It's negative for the culture itself. Abstractions within art, the poetry of art, is so important for the culture at large to be properly functioning. And there's been this kind of trotting upon the conceptual art as though it's a negative thing, which is very much related to what was happening, you know, in Nazi Germany. There was a famous art show that they put together, which they labeled degenerate art. And if you look at there's a documentary about it, and there's a book that has the collection of the art. And, you know, it's great kind of abstract work of surrealists and cubists and, you know, Jewish artists that they dislike that were fantastic artists. Well, you know, and we have so many things that are that don't really recognize that there's a correlation between that kind of thought process that was going on in Nazi Germany. And I don't mean to overly harbor on that, but at the same time, there are repercussions in this culture, in the United States, that when it treat any culture, whether it's Nazi Germany or the United States, that is not respecting abstractions in art, it's very damaging to the culture at large.
Yeah, I was going to say the period right before Nazi Germany was the Weimar period, which was very...
Great, yeah, great period of art. And that, of course, is the art that they were reacting to and, you know, putting into these... putting into this category of degenerate art. And I feel like it's I don't want to make the correlation too heavily, but the kind of abstraction and the kind of thought processes that were going on in the 1960s and 70s in the United States are more correlative to the Weimar Republic and what's been happening since the 80s, 90s, and particularly now has more correlation to what was going on after the Weimar Republic, which is very disturbing.
I just appreciate in an age when, you know, most people are communicating, you know, 140 characters or fewer, that your focus and, you know, I guess I'm being especially appreciative because you came on to my podcast and we can actually have like a half hour conversation unrushed. You know, right. So it's great to know that there's a brother out there who's writing a long book, frankly, who's does it without knowing who, you know, let's face it, you're right the length it's going to be. I don't, you know, you're not going to succumb to parameters that somebody else imposes on you, and I appreciate that. And you're doing these long Q&As, and you're, you know, the it's a great pushing back, I think.
Well, the other thing that I don't know if you listened or watched or read much of Noam Chomsky, but he made a very good point in A Manufacturing Consent about the constraint on television. Where he talks about content and fill in the advertisement industry or the sponsored industry of television, content is considered the advertisement in between, and the advertisement is the content, and the fill is the stuff they put in between.
Right.
So of course, and that's how things run everywhere. In the United States, So if you, it is a very strange thing about Twitter. I do have a Twitter account, but I don't post to it directly. I use Instagram, and I post photos of the property that I'm at right now, where I shot my film on sets. Mm-hmm. I built sets. I don't have any photos of those up yet. As the film gets closer to being released, that's the main part of what why I bought the property in the Czech Republic. But slowly, I'm showing photographs of the property, and once it gets into the sets and closer to the release of the film, I'll start showing photographs of the film as well. But I don't like the, like you said, the 140 characters. I think there is something positive about it in a way, but it doesn't work well with me. So I keep a visibility up online on my social media. I have a Twitter, I have an Instagram, I have a Facebook. I have two different Facebooks. One is the official Crispin Helling Glover Facebook page, and the other is the Crispin Helling Glover personal page. Just the way Facebook was set up years ago, it's a little bit confusing. I actually have more followers now you only were able to have 5,000 friends, but I actually have more followers on the Crispin Helling Glover page. But I have a substantial amount of people on the official Crispin Helling Glover page, so it's a little bit confusing. I have to post to both. But why I use Instagram is it posts to everything
right.
with just one post. So it's time saving. But yes, to be able to communicate, well, what I was starting to say about Noam Chomsky is if you have an opposing point of view to what the main corporate interest point of view is, it takes time. You have to give examples. You have to cite what those examples are from and give evidence that what you're talking about is accurate. And to do that takes time.
Nuance.
You can't just say, no, I disagree, because then everybody says, well, we hate you. We agree with that which is being put forth in media. So therefore, you're a jerk. So be quiet. Whereas if you're going along with what the corporate interests want, all you have to do is say yes. And then everybody goes, yes, we're all together. We all agree. But if you say no, mm-hmm. it takes more time because you have to give examples as to why these things are important and why they actually mean something. So that's why, yes, I tend toward being a little bit more comfortable often with being perhaps a bit too verbose. But it's easier to get something across that way, perhaps.
Well, I'm grateful because for my podcast, it's perfect, you know. So that's good for me.
Yeah.
So hey, so how will you your films, for instance? Where do they? You get them into festivals. I wouldn't doubt at all. And then after, how do you get them distributed since you are trying to go as non-corporate as possible, at least in the making of the films? I don't know, maybe the distribution is, Alamo Drafthouse is a great example because they will actually at least do some sort of screenings, if not theatricals, but at least they'll screen, you know.
I've been touring for 12 years now. I've had hundreds of shows, I haven't really calculated the amount of people that have seen the films, but I would say it's in the tens of thousands of people. I generally go to independent cinemas. I don't actually go to festivals in the United States that much. The only festivals I went to in the U.S. were
You mentioned Sundance.
Sundance Film Festival. What is it won best narrative film in 2005 at the Ann Arbor Film Festival, which is the oldest experimental film festival in the United States.
Is that right?
And I was just prior to that in 2005 before winning that award at the New York Underground Film Festival, which is a festival that no longer exists. Those are the only three festivals I've been to in the U.S. The rest of my touring in the U.S. has been at independent cinemas. Alamo is a interesting exception, although Tim League, who began Alamo,
He's been on the show too.
Person to contact me about what is it. He contacted me before I finished the film. And consequently, the Alamo Drafthouse Theater in Austin, Texas, was the very first venue I went to for a paying audience. And Tim League was still personally running the venue at that point. If you don't know, he's become sort of a media mogul at this point. He's opening I don't know how many Alamo Draft Houses there are, but they're dotted all across the United States, and they're continuing to grow. It's a fantastic organization. You know, I talk about corporations. Corporations, of course, don't have to be a bad thing.
Right.
It's just right. What I mean by corporate problems are that there's an out of balance problem. Obviously, the obvious examples are things like the pharmaceutical industry or what's happening with the gas and oil industries. Those are just way out of bounds. But something like what Tim League is doing is really a great corporation. Because he has the proper heart. He hires people that are genuine cinephiles. And years ago, when he and his wife were running the one in Austin, she let me know that the way they really bought their income in was through selling the beer. So they were able to – it didn't matter so much what they were programming corporately. Mm-hmm. And they were cinephiles. So they were able to show interesting, unusual, fun things that audiences actually enjoyed. And unusual things, not just the corporate stuff. Of course, it's expanded, and they do show corporate things, but there's a thought process going on behind it, and they are bringing in educational, thoughtful, older revival films all across the United States,
right.
which was not happening so much before. So there's an amalgamation of still independent movie theaters that are going on, which I'll go to, and then I've been having great experiences with the Alamo Drafthouse theaters as well.
Yeah.
Now the thing I'm doing in New Jersey is actually kind of unusual for me. I don't normally go to conventions, but this one is a film festival convention,
right?
And so I will be part of it, and I'll be doing my show exactly in the same way that I normally do my shows there, and it's very rare that I've been in New Jersey, so I'm looking forward to that as well.
I'm sure they are too. You know, Tim League, by the way, just so you know, I've done a couple of things with him. He's been on the show once, and and I did a thing at one of the South by Southwest festivals, and he was kind enough to be on the panel.
Good. Yeah, you know him then. You know he's a great fellow and a real advocate for interesting, thoughtful films.
And it's why I was at the Draft House, because, you know, you're right. Even though they for a number of reasons, they are always at locations which are a certain distance from another theater. So they're not trying to overshadow a local indie house or something like that.
They're very morally motivated as well. Like I know a lot of the venues sometimes get afraid of the Alamo draft houses, but Alamo they are genuine in that they want to be bringing film culture to the world. And they're not one of these predatory corporations that just is going to put up three cinemas to just put some other cinema out of business. They want to help promote film in a community. And if one kind of theater is going to do one, cinema is going to do one kind of thing, they want to support it and even advertise for it and do something different, that they have their niches. And the fact is, I've seen a very good example of how I see film as education working. I had some people approach me while I was doing the book signing. Mm-hmm. They came to me and said that they had a theater in Paducah, Kentucky. And I'd never heard of Paducah, Kentucky before they told me this. It's a great little venue called the Maiden Alley Cinema. And I went there with my shows and films. I had two excellent, well-sold shows. And the audience was an intelligent, thoughtful, educated, cinephile audience. And the reason it was an educated cinephile audience is because the Maiden Alley Cinema had been there for a decade. Mm-hmm. And those people, they were bringing interesting, thoughtful, intelligent movies to this smaller community. And so the people were learning these things. It was a genuine education as opposed to a propaganda. So this kind of thing is healthy when people start loving truly thoughtful film. They want more of it. They want this in their lives. It's not something that should be looked down upon. And unfortunately, corporate propaganda, people go to it because that's what's put in front of them.
Right.
It isn't because they're really craving it, or or they become genuinely propagandized, and yes, then they do crave this thought.
They become the foot soldiers, then it's something, you know, when they're...
Yeah, and then they'll criticize something that's more thoughtful, and that's what definitely is happening right now, which is dangerous to the culture at large. That's kind of what I was talking about when I was mentioning the show that called Degenerate Art. When people start looking at things that are thoughtful as degenerate, that's when it becomes scary. And I've certainly seen that happen, even with my own films. I mean, my films are designed to cause questions and discomfort, and I've always known there would be a certain amount of that happening. But I've even seen it sometimes happening within mechanisms, cinemas, that people that are working at the cinemas started hearing to that kind of thought process. And it goes against the mission statement of the cinema, which is these are often not-for-profit organizations that get people donating money to be bringing more unusual, thoughtful films. And that's not always what's happening. Usually it is. I've had it happen very rarely, and I've seen it happen very rarely, but it just the fact that it's happening at all is disturbing. I get concerned about that kind of thing.
I relate to you completely. Do you feel like your films, though, are they're put in genre category right often, right?
My personal films?
Yeah, the ones you're directing.
Well, I will put them in a genre. I don't know that other people would put them in a genre.
Genre film, meaning they're like horror or, you know what I'm saying?
My personal films are not horror films. When I'm saying personal films, I'm meaning the films that I direct.
Yeah, no, I know what you're talking about. Very good. Okay.
So I've acted in horror films, but I've never directed a horror film. My films... You could, it would be stretching it to call my films, the second film, It Is Fine, Everything Is Fine, you could put it possibly in the category of psychological terror, but here's the category I would put my films in.
Please.
I would call my films dramas with humor.
Because I'm sorry, then I misinterpreted, because when I saw that it was at the New Jersey Horror Convention and Film Festival.
The reason that I'm at the festival is because, for example, John Waters was at the same exact festival last year, and his films would not be categorized in horror films either. It's a festival that brings in various things. Europe, they have a different name for it. Here in the U.S., they generally categorize film festivals into science fiction or horror or sometimes fantasy.
A genre.
In Europe, they kind of categorize those same films into something called fantastique film festivals, which I think is a better way of doing it, because yes, they'll have horror or science fiction or fantasy or surrealism,
or crude comedies, films, even crude comedies, maybe,
dark comedy.
Dark comedies.
My films, beyond that, they can be put into a fantastical category.
And Tim League has the Fantastic Fest, which is all of these types of films. You know, he does them at the South. Yeah, and
I've never been part of that festival, but I'm glad that he's calling it.
They're doing. As a matter of fact, they're
Fantastic Festival, because I think it's a better title.
Yeah, it's called Fantastic Fest, and no doubt it's based on what you're talking about in Europe. And now they're actually going to do a mini Fantastic Fest weekend right after you're gone here at the Alamo Draft House. They're going to be doing like a weekend version.
Yeah, somebody was telling me about it. I was at a number of Alamos this year, so
it's a perfect venue for you.
It's a traveling
roadshow.
Group of I'm glad they're doing that. But again, it's a good example of the kind of thing that Alamos doing that's very positive.
In festivals, they call those films that we're talking about, they call it genre. That's, you know, it was my shorthand, but in a way, I kind of...
Right, I know what you mean. Yeah, okay. Of course, genre, you generally think of something like horror, science fiction, Western, yeah. Comedy, etc.
Right.
I would put my films in the genre of fantastique is probably the better genre to put call the films.
Well, I don't even know. See, even I slide a little bit towards, I wouldn't say I'm sucked into the corporatizing, but you know, all that breaking into genres is a very corporate approach in a way too, because I come out of a corporate music industry background. I worked at Sony Music for years, and I was really, even though I enjoyed the experience and I learned and I grew a lot as a result of it, I was very disgusted by just how the music industry categorizes and puts every kinds of singer into a specific genre. And if an artist doesn't fit, they don't survive in almost every case. So I shouldn't even be so caught up, I guess is my point. I shouldn't get so caught up in trying to categorize your films or anybody else's. But, you know, that's the way of...
Understand it. It doesn't have to be necessarily a negative thing.
It's a shorthand, you know.
But it would definitely be wrong to call my films horror films. They're what is it in particular was a, you know, I can get more and more specific about what each one of them are, but it had a early Buñuel influence.
Oh yeah, I see that.
So specifically, Buñuelian surrealism was something that I was very much focused upon while I was particularly editing What Is It? Mm-hmm. Stephen C. Stewart's film, because he wrote it based on TV murder mystery movies of the week that were playing in the 1970s, the cinematic syntax is more standard in terms of the way the cinematic story flows. It's more the kind of cinematic syntax that we're used to seeing in corporately funded and distributed film. However, Steve's vision, what he was bringing forth about his own life and making it an autobiographical element within this TV murder mystery movie genre style, mm-hmm. There's something fascinating about the truths that end up coming through in his film. That's why his, on some level, falls a little more into, you could possibly call it psychological terror, but it's more complex than just even that. It's really a very beautiful film. So yes, in a certain way, they're a little bit hard to categorize in that way. I broadly call them dramas with humor, but yes, they're more specific than that.
Well, that's good enough description anyway. Oh, by the way, League does, by the way, now have a bigger distribution company. He was running Drafthouse Films, and now that's sort of an, I think, defunct, but now he has a new company called Neon.
Right. Yeah, people are telling me about that. Okay.
You're keeping up.
I'm interested to find out more about that stuff, and I'm sure Tim League is going to continue to do very well, particularly with Alamo Drafthouse, but whatever he's doing alongside of those things with his own distribution, it's an interesting element where he was obviously just really a real cinephile that happened to also be a good business person. A lot of people start out as business people and they don't have the heart, mm-hmm. and to really make it continue to grow, but Tim League has the proper heart of the he loves the movies and the unusual, thoughtful movies. That is what people, when they're really cinephiles get into. So that's what's great about the Draft House, is that there is that Tim League has been, somehow he just happens to be an excellent business person, and he's bringing the heart into the to Alamo Draft House as a chain, which of course it could lose it. It's the kind of thing that could be easily lost. Mm-hmm. And I started working with them in 2005, and I've been so happy to see that the heart remains, whether Tim is at the venue or not. I'm very glad to be working with them in the way that I have been.
I'm going to have to come down to the Draft House on the weekend of the 23rd and 20 excuse me on the 19th and 20th, because I definitely need to catch up with those films. And
I'll put you on the list. I'd love to have you come and see it. That's the other thing that's a funny thing, is I so often am doing these interviews, and of course it's a difficult part of what I do, because I purposefully keep the films off of the internet and the shows off of the internet and the Q&As off of the internet. I do it because at this point in time, essentially, once something is digitally out there, even if it's illegal for people to do it, it becomes a kind of a public domain.
Yeah.
And that isn't good for being able to recoup on these various things, which is important if somebody wants to be able to justify continuing to make more of their own films. And so I've had to be very careful about maintaining these as private events, but it's very much opposition to the way most films are distributed. They come out briefly, and then everybody essentially sees them, whether they've paid for them or not, and there's kind of a dialogue or an influence that happens. I would like to do that with my films, but I would not be able to be continuing to slowly recoup on the films. I essentially recouped 6 years into touring for both of the films. But when I say recoup, 50% of that is by the live performance, 25% of that is by the book sales, and 25% of that is by the box office. So what that means is, to truly recoup from the box office of the films, I would have to tour four times that six-year time period, which would mean a 24-year touring. But the funny thing is I'm on year 12, so I'm halfway there. I'm not sure what's going to happen with the future of my films, in terms of whether I would start to have a more standardized kind of corporate type distribution. I would like that. If I could make it work monetarily, I would certainly do it. Again, I'm not against corporate distribution. Certainly, Stanley Kubrick was working in the most corporate distribution in the studio system, with films like 2001 and The Clockwork Orange. And these are some of the most thoughtful films and cinematic films that have ever been made. It's a very different kind of filmmaking that is being allowed to be corporately financed and distributed at this point. So I would love it if that was what was being corporately financed and distributed, and I would love to be a part of it. And perhaps that will happen. I don't see that happening quickly, but with things like the Alamo Draft House, I see positive aspects of genuinely thoughtful and challenging kind of movie making having a larger impact again on the culture, which I do think is a positive thing to have happen, and and that's what I'm aspiring towards.
Well, you know, when the time comes, we should talk, because I definitely have my ear to the ground around these things. Maybe you picked up a little on that through the conversation, but I'm in the abstract. If there's any opportunity where I can be part of something that's so, I guess, organic and driven by art for art's sake, then, you know, I'm real excited about it. So, I'm expanding what I do. I'm actually about to do my first ever fundraiser myself. Speaking of financing and all.
A lot of people are feeling the way I do, I'm sure.
You know, and in Brooklyn, you really meet a lot of young filmmakers with a lot of they're still in that phase where you can get them. And if there's actual channels for people like that, where they can actually focus. I have a good friend who I just saw his new film in their loft apartment in Brooklyn the other day. And it's exactly the kind of thing we're talking about, you know?
Yeah.
And he doesn't want to go corporate distribution. He really doesn't want it as an act of choice, which is very refreshing.
Well, it's a weird, you know? Corporate distribution would be great if it distributed interesting things. Sometimes it does, even still.
Right.
There are corporate films every once in a while that are genuinely interesting.
And that's why they don't dumb down.
It's not the majority.
No.
And that's what it should be. It should be the majority of films that are both corporately financed and distributed are thoughtful, challenging, educational movies, as opposed to movies that are made to bring forth the corporate interest into the minds of the working class, which is not what serves the working class. And the working class and the lower class does not understand that that's what's happening, because the propaganda is effective. And this is something that needs to be discussed, and again is a big part of why I'm working on the book that I'm working on right now.
Well, I'm excited how this turned out, you know. And
yeah, me too. I'm glad this all worked out. This is a good conversation. We'll have to do it again.
Well, I was going to say, for sure, especially maybe when your book is, maybe you're ready to release that. I think that would be a great opportunity, for instance, just as far as, for instance. And
yeah, and I say you should come to the shows.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll put you on the list, and we can have a more detailed discussion about the content of the films and shows at that point.
Yeah. For sure. I'm almost certain I can make that happen, at least.
Yeah, just email me and let me know, and I'll put you on the list.
Okay. Yeah, I think that the 19th is good. I can do this later, I guess. But all right, well, thank you very much. I'm going to say it one more time, because I have it now actually in front of me, so I don't even have to say that I sound like I'm not even positive. On September 19th at the Alamo Drafthouse, Crispin Hellion Glover's Big Slideshow, Part 2. It's fine, everything is fine, and then followed by a Q&A, and then a book signing. And then on September 20th, same at the Alamo Drafthouse, you'll be doing a slideshow Part 1. What is it? And then a Q&A followed by a book signing again. And then you'll be on the September 23rd and 24th at the Woodbridge Township, New Jersey, at the New Jersey Horror Convention and Film Festival, doing the same events. And we'll show on those 2 days, and we'll put up all the links and everything else.
Great. Okay. That sounds fantastic.
Thank you so much.
All right. Oh, terrific. Yeah, thank you, Adam. We'll talk again.
Okay.
And send me an email, and I'll put you on the list.
I'm going to do that right now.
All right, great. Okay. All right, great to talk.
Same here.
All right, thanks a lot.
All right, have a safe trip to the States next week or the week after, whenever it is.
Thank you. All right, bye.
All right, bye-bye.
Now starring in a motion picture called River's Edge. Folks, please welcome Crispin Glover. Hi, how are you?
Good.
Nice to see you.
Good to see you too.
How are you doing?
Good, I'm really good.
Are things going all right this summer?
I'm having a very good summer.
Yeah. Where do you live now? You live in Los Angeles?
Yes, that's right, in Los Angeles. Uh-huh. I just bought a nice condominium.
Condominium, where's it located?
It's located just over the hill in the valley, and I'm really happy about it.
Did you for a time you lived in Hollywood? You lived on Hollywood Boulevard?
In Hollywood Boulevard.
On Hollywood Boulevard?
No.
Had an apartment overlooking Hollywood Boulevard? Had a big high building you lived in? Big tower on Hollywood?
No. No.
All right. Then we'll just drop that and go on to something else, all right? Do you do a lot of television shows?
Oh, yes, now because I've been in movies that are big and I'm a movie star, so I've been on talk shows on the Johnny Carson show, yep. And now I'm here and I've been all across the United States and I feel really good about it, so.
Do you enjoy the experience?
Yes, I feel very good about them.
I notice you have something there in the case.
I knew that this was going to happen, and I can I tell you, because the press, they can do things, they can twist things around, and because the you're talking, I don't look, I. The press says things about you in the paper. This is a paper, the L.A. Weekly in Los Angeles, and they said about me, la-di-da, it was at, I went to a club, and they said that it was at a meeting, and it said Crispin Glover, who was in a frenzy, though his bark is actually worse than his dot, dot, dot. You get the point. Mm-hmm. And
Paul, anything you'd like to add here?
And then another one, they said Crispin Glover.
Paul, is this the first time you've seen another guy drown? Is this the first time you've watched a guy die?
Is that you're talking about you or
yeah,
him?
Yeah, no, me.
This is the other thing. They said Crispin Glover was pinstriped and greased up for the occasion, impressing the girl things who are trying to get next to him. Guess some people are turned on by Brill Cream.
Yeah, well, I don't know.
And then they... I don't have these...
You seem to be distraught.
They don't...
You seem to be distraught.
People try to make me sound a lot weird, and yeah. I'm just... I'm strong, you know? I'm strong. I can arm wrestle. Do you want to arm wrestle?
No.
I've been taking,
no.
You know, I've taken part. These aren't mine. I can kick.
Okay. Okay. Hey, I'm going to go check on the top 10.
No,
I'll be back. Welcome back to the show. We're running a little short of time tonight. I would have loved to have chatted more with Crispin Glover, but I understand he had a cab to catch, and, well, traffic this time of night here in Midtown is pretty brutal, so we wanted to ensure every possibility that he would get wherever he was going on time. Did you enjoy that, Paul?
It was an interesting segment.
Yeah. I think that's the first time we've been doing the show that a guest actually tried to kick me.
Well, I think it was a conceptual piece.
Well, he came very close to denting my head with those giant shoes. So I thought, I don't need that. I'm 40. I went to college. I've had a number of. I don't need this. That is not how I want my life ended. Some goofball, some dork from wherever. Oh, stop it! Stop it! Yeah, you want to have dinner with the guy? Let me, this is more of a rhetorical question. And he isn't.